Welcome everybody. This is the 10th lecture in my course, Purification, Ethics and Karma in Early Buddhist Discourse. So, a few announcements again. Last time, some had a problem of accessing this live session in Connect. Also, some had a problem of accessing the video in the OLAT on the webpage, or in posting messages on the blog. With all these problems, I am unfortunately fairly helpless. I have myself spent a number of hours trying to figure out all these technical issues so that I can barely handle presenting the material, and I'm simply not able to do anything about these type of technical problems. I think in each case, it would be good if you could contact the support team. This is also for them to know what kind of problems we have with all these new software, so that in the future they can improve or get updates or whatever. I think there's a comment by Andrew coming, so I wait for that. Well, maybe I continue, and whenever Andrew is ready, then I turn to what he's saying. But basically, with these technical problems, I'm not able to do much. So today I will start reviewing first of all the Madhyama Agama 15 that looked at last time. There were these two statements that they are right at the beginning. If a person does an action intentionally, then he will have to experience its result, either in this life or in the next life, I say. And the second statement, if a person does an action unintentionally, then he will not have to experience the result, I say. And there was a question about this second statement in the blog. There's no picture. Oh gosh. Can you see me now? What about the sound? What about the sound now? Is it any better? I'm just keep on talking and... Oh gosh. I'll just check again on... Preferences... So I'm trying now, I've changed something with the audio setup. Is it any better now? It's getting better? Oh, good. So can we continue with this kind of... Well, I can't change the picture of that foolish monk in front of you, but at least with the audio. Okay. Thank you for letting me know. There's one more comment apparently. Okay. I throw out the chat. And I start my announcement again where I was saying that I'm not good at technical things, as you just saw. I'm not a complete failure. Anyhow, there were some problems some people had last time accessing the Live Connect session. Some had problems accessing the video on the website, and some had problems posting message on the blog. And in all these cases, I'm not able to be of much help because I don't know much about these technical issues. So it's good if you can write to the support team, letting them know that there are problems. It's not only for your own benefit or of the other participants of this course, but also so that these people know what are the type of problems we experience with this kind of software, so they can maybe hopefully improve things for future courses. Okay, now I turn to my review of Madhyama Agama 15. If at any point of my presentation the tone doesn't become clear, then please let me know. I read out a statement that was there at the beginning of Madhyama Agama 15. If a person does an action intentionally, then he will have to experience its result, either in this life or in the next life, I say. If a person does an action unintentionally, then he will not have to experience the result, I say. There was a question on the blog regarding the implication or the meaning of this statement and what the point is about doing an action unintentionally. And I thought that was a good question, and we got a very good answer by Darshana Makavita. He gave a very nice example. He says, I tried to put a bag into a rack in a bus and I hit a person on the head. My intention was to put the bag into the rack, which I did, but some other action happened also which was not intended. So that is exactly the point. Sometimes something we do, it's not our intention, and that is an action done unintentionally. And since Darshana had no intention to hit that other person on the head, then he will not get any karmical retribution for the intention of hurting another person. If he was very careless when putting that bag up onto the rack, then he will have to bear the karmical retribution for being careless, maybe. But sometimes these things can even happen without being careless, so then there's no karmical retribution for him to be experienced by this action. And Linda Grace felt that she had a comment on this part. She said it seems odd in terms of its placement in this sutta, because while the first sentence is then illustrated in terms of the 10 causes of unwholesome action, the second sentence is not further illustrated. I thought about that, but it seems to me the whole point is that with this second sentence, action that is done unintentionally is just set aside, that that's not an issue, because the whole point that we will be getting after is about karmic retribution. So I feel it says, the statement says, look, if you do something intentionally, you will have to experience its results. Only if there's no intention on your part, then there's no result. So that second part sets it aside. The first part says, look, if you do something intentionally, there'll be a result, this life or the next life. And then the whole discourse works through what the implications of this statement are. Then there was another statement in the discourse after we get the description of the development of the Brahma-viharas, the divine abodes of loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. I read the statement again. If the learned noble disciple, whose mind is now immeasurable and well-cultivated, had earlier been negligent because of bad friends and had done unwholesome actions, then he will no longer be led along by them. They cannot corrupt him and will not accompany him further. This is a little cryptic also in the Pali counterpart. I think there are several layers of meaning there. The main point, I assume, from the perspective of tradition is that by developing the Brahma-viharas, one creates such a powerful karma that the next rebirth is definitely going to be in the Brahma world, if the Brahma Viharas are fully developed up to jhana level of absorption. And so if somebody has done some unwholesome deeds in the present life, who would normally take the retribution in the next life, he or she can kind of counterbalance that by developing the Brahma Viharas and thereby going beyond the fruition of this karma in the next life. And I would personally add that we could also interpret it in a more immediate sense for those of us who do not believe in this idea of rebirth, that even in the present situation, if I am an anger type, somebody who has had a lot of angry reactions in the past and therefore has a way of reacting with anger in the present, then the results of this tendency can be counterbalanced by the development of the Brahma Viharas. And just take the first one to make things easy. If I keep on practicing loving kindness, that changes my perception of others. What earlier irritated me and causes me to react with anger now is a challenge to my metta. It doesn't irritate me in the first place so much, and my reaction to that is that I practice loving kindness. So the whole way how my behavior pattern has been shaped by my own past actions of anger and irritation is getting changed in the present. And I'm no longer led along by them, I'm no longer corrupted by them, I'm no longer accompanied by this type of anger. But this is my personal interpretation. According to tradition and what I assume the commentary tradition would hold, though I did not look it up on this particular point, is that the issue is about rebirth in the Brahma world. And the same appears to be also the point in the parallel Pali passage, which more explicitly speaks of the past deeds that have been done with one's physical body. When the Brahma Viharas are developed and rebirth in the Brahma world is attained, one goes beyond the physical realm, the so-called sense realm. One gets a fine material body, and any karma that is related or is to be experienced by having a physical body will not be able to affect somebody who is developed in rebirth in this higher realm. However, rebirth in the Brahma world would not settle the issue for good from an early Buddhist perspective. What is really required is to become an arahant. And here we have the statement in the Madhyama Agama version. You might remember there was this simile about the young boy or girl, and then this statement, "Monks, you should think like this. Formerly I was negligent and did unwholesome deeds. Let all their results be experienced now, not in the next life. One who practices liberation of the mind through loving kindness in this way, immeasurable and well cultivated, will definitely attain the fruit of non-returning, or else attain that which is still higher." So I think the point of this injunction, let all my karmic results be experienced now and not in the next life, I understand this to be an aspiration for becoming an arahant in the present life. I think I told you already about the story about Angulimala, murderer. He had killed quite a number of victims according to the story we are told. And kind of somewhat bizarre story, apparently he had been told that he has to kill so and so many people by his teacher. And this whole massive killing that he had done, the karmic retribution for that could only affect him in his present life. Because after he met the Buddha, he stopped killing, became a Buddhist monk, developed his practice, became an arahant. as an arahant, he was not going to have any future life. Therefore, all the karmic retribution for killing that was pending to have its results when he was going to be reborn, and he would have been reborn in hell for what he did, all that becomes defunct because it doesn't get any more an occasion to come to fruition. And I mean, we could understand this. Formerly I was negligent and did unwholesome deeds in the sense of referring to his present lifetime in the case of Angulimala. We could also go further back if we wish. One of the discourses on Angulimala, I believe it's the Ekotarika Agama version, gives us also a record of what he did in the past that caused him to get into the situation of, in his present life, being commanded to kill others. So there's always a precedent. But actually, this is not of such a central concern for us, whether we did something so and so many lives ago, whether it's done in the present life. I mean, the main point is that according to early Buddhist karma theory, which is one of the central topics we are discussing at present, any intentionally done action has a result. We saw before with the simile of the piece of salt that result depends on the overall development of the person. Throwing the piece of salt in the cup of water in a river has a different effect on the drinkability of the water. And there is a way of cutting things completely off. There is a temporary escape by developing the Brahma Viharas and making sure one is reborn the next life in the Brahma world. That stops the karma from having fruition in the next life, but it doesn't get completely beyond the range of this karma. And there is the way of cutting things off for good, which is by becoming an arahant or by becoming a non-returner. A non-returner will be reborn in a higher heavenly realm where these certain karmas also cannot take fruition. At this point, I would invite any kind of question in regard to Madhyama Agama 15 or what I have said so far. Nobody typing, no questions? Oh yeah, here's again the summary of the main teachings of Madhyama Agama 15. I don't think we need to go through that. Yeah, I turn to the other discourse we discussed last time, the discourse to the Kalamas. This has not received so much attention on the blog, but I would still like to discuss it quite in detail, because I think there is a rather strong difference, and it's important for us to explore that a little more, I think. So in the Madhyama Agama version, we have in both discourses, we have the situation that the Kalamas come to the Buddha and they tell him, look, there's all these spiritual teachers, we may call them, and they have this view and the other one has the opposite view. And so in the Madhyama Agama version, the Buddha tells them, Kalamas, do not doubt. Why? When there is doubt, hesitation arises. In the Anguttara Nikaya version, he says exactly the opposite. He says, this is enough for you to be perplexed. It is enough for you to have doubt. Doubt has arisen in you in regard to a perplexing matter. So here he actually encourages that doubt. He says, you are quite right to be doubting about this. This is a doubtful issue. And in the Anguttara Nikaya version, then we get this listing of different grounds for knowledge not found in the Madhyama Agama. And then this very famous statement, I read it out again for you. When you know for yourself, these things are unwholesome, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise. These things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to harm and suffering. Then you should abandon them. I stop because there's a question. How about other versions? Is there the same omission? With the Kalama Sutta, we are in the unfortunate situation of having only two versions. We only, so far known, who knows, someday there might be some Sanskrit fragment cropping up from some place in Afghanistan, hopefully. But I am only aware of two versions, the Pali and the Chinese. And these are the two we have. Unfortunately, among those discourses preserved for us in Tibetan translation, there is no extract of the Kalama Sutta. Yeah, Manfred, I wish we had another version. This passage has been bugging me for a little while, but I can't help it. The interesting thing is that exactly the same difference recurs in relation to another discourse, which we will turn to next week. This is the Patthaliya Sutta. We have a discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya. Well, not necessary for me to give you the information. We will look at it next week. It's Samyutta Nikaya, discourse 13, the section 42, and the Madhyama Agama Parallels number 20. The same situation, this Patthaliya, as we will see next week, he comes to the Buddha, he is perplexed by the views by some other teachers, and in the Madhyama Agama version, the Buddha replies, "Do not let doubt arise in you." Whereas in the Samyutta Nikaya version, we get exactly the same statement as in the Anguttara Nikaya. It is enough for you to be perplexed. It is enough for you to have doubt. Doubt has arisen in you in regard to a perplexing matter. So this basic difference is not a difference restricted to one discourse, but we see we have the same issue with another otherwise unrelated discourse. Yeah, one thing, Manfred asks, may that be a cultural omission because the Chinese think about authority, so Buddhism did not get into conflict with the powers that be. This is a possible explanation. It's a rather strong querying of authority and a different perspective on the significance of doubt. However, I need to, before I continue examining this rather crucial difference, I need to make one point regarding the Pali Kalama Sutta and the way I think it should be understood. You see, often the Kalama Sutta is quoted as beautiful title, The Buddha's Charter of Free Inquiry, basically telling us that we shouldn't accept anything from others. I'm exaggerating a little bit. Anything has to be grounded on our own experience, and that is the true testing stone for whatever teachings we receive. I have my reservations about this type of interpretation. Because if we look closely at the Kalama Sutta and also at the other sutta I mentioned, the Patthaliya Sutta, we find that the issue at stake is matters of morality. In both instances, those who come and visit the Buddha are non-Buddhists. They are non-Buddhists, they are confused by different views proposed by various teachers, and they ask the Buddha, what is the situation? So what the Buddha is expounding to them is just about ethics. He's not teaching them about the Four Noble Truths, there's not the Eightfold Noble Path, or anything of this deeper Buddhist teachings usually given to those who have embarked on the path of practice under the Buddha, who have recognized the Buddha as their teacher. So, what this Charter of Free Inquiry is about, I think, is about the basics of ethical conduct. In fact, we get ethics and we get the development of the Brahma Viharas. There's a question by Manfred. In any case, it is out of style. The Buddha often asks monks, do you believe or do you know? Yeah, I'm not fully understanding the point you're making, Manfred. You might mean the difference between accepting something on belief and accepting something on one's own knowledge. If that is the case, I'm kind of going towards that, but I wanted to first clarify the significance of the Kalama Sutta, because I feel sometimes it's being overinterpreted. The Chinese versions, you are still referring to the difference between the two versions. Yeah. Yeah, my own feeling is that I have more confidence in the Pali version than the Chinese. Because as you pointed out, there would be reasons for changing such a statement. And also, as I will shortly try to show, there is another discourse which confirms this kind of position, and there it's also found in the Madhyama Agama version. Anyway, coming back to the point that I was trying to make just on the Pali version of the Kalama Sutta is that the basics, principles of ethical conduct, ethics being one of the themes we are discussing at present, are directly verifiable. This is the basic message. And we get a... So this is this what I read for you. We can know for ourselves that things are unwholesome because they afflict us and others. And that is the basic measuring rod given there. But now coming back to if I understood him correctly, Manfred was also referring to the difference in perspective that we have been getting between the Pali tradition and the Madhyama Agama. There is another discourse, the Vimamsaka Sutta, that is Majjhima Nikaya discourse number 47, and this discourse has a parallel in the Madhyama Agama 186. This is so far away that it will take a couple of years for us to get there, so I thought I might already take a little look at it now. And this discourse, in my own view, is even more powerful in the range of free investigation it allows, because here, according to this discourse, the Buddha himself invites a prospective disciple to thoroughly scrutinize him in every possible respect. In view of the position of a teacher, so-called guru in quotation marks, in ancient India, this is highly remarkable. And the investigation that this discourse proposes goes through four different steps that I would like to briefly present to you. The first is searching for impurities by empirical observation. A prospective disciple of the Buddha who does not have telepathic powers and therefore is not able to directly gauge the mind of another person. Such a disciple should check the purity of the Buddha, of his future teacher, of his teacher who claims to be awakened. He should closely observe the behavior of the teacher, how he acts, how he speaks, what he does, in order to see if there is any type of behavior that is not in accordance with the claim that this teacher makes to be fully awakened. So the Buddha is here, according to this discourse, opening up himself for the most scrutinizing investigation of his conduct in every possible respect. When the prospective disciple has come to the conclusion this supposedly a fully awakened teacher is really absolutely pure in his ethical conduct in every respect, the next step, the number two, is scrutiny of the attitude of the teacher. These are just my headings. They are not like this in the sutta. Here now, the next step is that the prospective disciple should check how is this teacher handling the role of being a teacher. How is he handling fame and having become an object of worship and honor? The main point is to see if the teacher is given in to the attraction of being an important and famous person, if he is attached to his role as a teacher or to her role if that's a female teacher. This investigation concluded by finding out that this teacher is not attached to his role as a teacher. There's a next step, a direct questioning of the teacher. At this point, the prospective disciple is told, you go directly to the teacher and ask him, hey, are you seriously fully awakened? Are you really, are you totally pure? Is there any impurity in you? I find this the most, almost say outrageous aspect of this investigation. It's direct challenging the teacher. It's not meant to be a challenge, it's meant to be an investigation, but in view of the respect that ancient Indian tradition accords to the teacher, I find this really challenging. Now, when the teacher has been checked in all these aspects, checked for observable impurities, checking the attitude of the teacher to his role, and directly asking the teacher, then comes the point to place faith or confidence in him, saddha. Sufficient confidence for giving the teaching of this person a try. And the true confidence in the teacher, however, comes only into place when the disciple has reached personal verification, step number 4 in the scheme I present here. When the disciple has followed the path laid out by this teacher and has personally come to realization. Then only at this point the faith is something that is rooted in personal experience and become unshakable. And I think the thorough scrutiny, the thorough testing that these 4 steps present shows clearly the importance that was given to free inquiry in Buddhist thought. Manfred asked, have you tried 3? In Thailand you would not get an answer. Yeah, I'm not saying that this is the way modern day teachers are handling their position as a teacher. I am only saying that according to the discourses that we have at our position, this is how the founder of Buddhism, the Buddha, presumably allowed his own prospective disciple to investigate him. How far this is being put into practice is a matter that I better not comment on, I think. What this presentation shows us, I think, and I think it also to some extent supports the reading of the Pali Kalama Sutta and the Pali Patalya Sutta, is that doubt in the sense of initial questioning and investigation has its place in Buddhism. Doubt is not all times and every time something bad. But, certainly, doubt is one of the 5 hindrances, hindrances to deeper meditation. And doubt is a fetter that will be overcome by stream entry. In fact, we had a reference to this earlier when we discussed the stages of purification. You might remember there was one, purification by overcoming doubt. So doubt has its rightful place in the initial parts of the path, but eventually it's something that will be left behind. And so besides this, obviously, positive role given to doubt in the passages that we looked at so far, there are also negative evaluations of doubt. There are a few similes I just briefly mentioned. One is, doubt is comparable to staying at the junction of a forked path. This is Samyutta Nikaya, volume 3, page 108. We don't know which way to go, we need somebody else to tell us. Doubt in the teacher, in the teachings, and in the community is reckoned a mental barrenness, chitukila, something that makes the mind dry. And in a series of similes for the different hindrances, I'm just giving one reference. Did I say the other reference for the chitukila, Majjhima Nikaya, volume 101? And now Digha Nikaya, volume 1, page 73. This overcoming the hindrance of doubt is similar to safely crossing a dangerous desert. This image of desert and the mental barrenness give us the same kind of imagery of a of a difficult, dry kind of journey. And we get another simile, a series of similes for the hindrances, where somebody is taking a bowl full of water to look at the reflection of his or her own face. And so when this bowl of water is placed in a dark room, and the water itself is muddy and dirty, then one is not able to see the reflection of one's own face. And the same happens when doubt is in the mind. Now, I want to briefly turn to what I find a rather interesting and significant passage on doubt as a hindrance, in particular in relation to concentration meditation. This is the Upakhinkilesa Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 128, and its parallel in Majjhima Agama 72. The discourse is a rather long discourse, but this describes, I think Lens Cousins already said that, and I agree with him, that this is one of the canonical passages that clearly point to the nimitta, the light experience that leads into absorption meditation. Be that as it may, it definitely describes a series of upakilesas, of finer defilements or more subtle defilements that need to be overcome in order to get into jhana, into absorption meditation. And the interesting thing is that the series sets in without mentioning the first two hindrances, sensual desire and ill will or aversion. And I would interpret that to mean that the point of passage in the progress towards deepening concentration that this discourse is dealing with is precisely when inner visions, light and the nimitta arises, when the mind moves from the normally experienced world of the outer sense doors to an inner world of purely mental experiences and visions. And so in describing these different hindrances, the first mention is doubt. And the Pali version says, it is the Buddha himself speaking to a group of monks, telling him about his own overcoming of these hindrances as a way of teaching them how they should do the same. He says, "Doubt arose in me. On account of doubt, my concentration fell away." But the Majjhima Agama version gives us a little more explicit and longer passage. "What in the world does not exist? Can I see? Can I come to know that? In my mind this doubt arose. Because of this doubt, my concentration was lost." I find this Majjhima Agama longer passage very useful because it describes to my mind exactly what happens when somebody is deepening concentration, and this from the normal perspective of the world, unreal world of inner visions and purely mental experiences begins to open up, and there is this uncertainty. Am I seeing something that does not exist? What is really happening here? And this is precisely the type of doubt that makes difficulty in stabilizing concentration. There's a remark here by Manfred. "Doubting mind, skepticism versus inquiring mind, thirst for truth, knowledge. The last one can go along with saddha, faith." Yeah. Thank you. In fact, that fits very well with what I wanted to say next. I wanted to go from doubt as a obstruction, as a hindrance to concentration meditation, to doubt in relation to insight. Hedwig, if you're writing something for me, it's not coming through. I just see you typing, but nothing is arriving here. This presentation in the discourses that has this concept of nutriment, nourishing, something that nourishes or that denourishes a certain mental condition or factor. And so we are told the nutriment for doubt, or that which nourishes doubt, is ayonisho manasikara, I translate this a little freely as unwise attention now. And this is directed to the distinction between what is wholesome and unwholesome, or if you wish, skillful and unskillful, kusala and akusala. Now, interestingly, the nutriment or nourishment for the bodhyanga, the awakening factor, dhammavicaya, investigation of dhammas, is yoniso manasikara, wise attention to the same topic, to what the distinction between what is wholesome and unwholesome. So you see the same, what nourishes doubt is the not nourishing of investigation of dhammas. What nourishes investigation of dhammas is the not nourishing or the depleting of nourishment of doubt. I think this is very significant because it makes a very important point, which I believe, if I understood Manfred correctly, he was already making in his comment now. In Buddhism, according to early Buddhist meditation theory, if I may so call it, faith is not what is required to overcome doubt, but rather investigation. This is exactly what the Kalama Sutta tells us. This is what the Vimamsa Sutta tells us. This is also relevant to this Upakilesa Sutta. It's an investigation of these new experiences by which one will overcome doubt. And the final culmination of overcoming doubt is stream entry. When someone has undertaken such a thorough investigation of reality that the first experience of nirvana takes place. And with that experience, doubt about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, what is skillful and what is unskillful, is gone forever. At this point again, I would like to invite any questions or comments. Yeah, then there was just another brief point about the four assurances that we were getting at the end of Madhyama Agama 16. We are now back after this little excursion into the Vimamsaka and Upakilesa Sutta. We are now back with our Madhyama Agama discourse. The third assurance in the Madhyama Agama was, whatever I have done, I have certainly done no evil, and I recollect no evil. In the Anguttara version, a little tricky passage in the Pali, which I have tried my own limited ability in translating, if by merely acting, merely in brackets, evil is done, at least in brackets, I am not intending evil for anyone. Well, I can give you the Pali, I have it just here, for anybody to correct my translation. The point I understand this passage to make is related to a belief held among some of the contemporaries of the Buddha in ancient India, who were thinking that action in itself is something that creates evil. There was the belief, for example, that by moving in any way, I'm inevitably going to harm other living beings. And the concept of living beings in some tradition even includes like the elements, earth, water, fire and air. So it's basically impossible for me to do anything without harming. And even speaking is a problem. Any word I say is going to create evil. And so the notion then came that one should not speak, one should be completely silent, and one should not move, and ideally even not undertake any type of action at all. Buddhism clearly disagrees with these kind of notions and ideas, and instead emphasizes the importance of intention. But again, this teaching given here is not to Buddhists, but to those outside of Buddhism. And so the point, I think, that is being made is here that even if action in itself already creates evil according to the view of these other Brahmins and recluses, it can't be helped, but at least I'm not intending to do evil. I'm not wanting anybody to get harmed. That much I can at least be sure. And then, I don't remember offhand, but I believe the fourth assurance is then, if actions do not create evil by themselves, then I'm safe on both accounts. That is, my intentions are pure and my acting. Yeah, that was my review of the two discourses that we discussed last time. Here again for you the main points of the second discourse. So unless there's some question, I would then like to continue with the next one in the list, Madhyama Agama 17. The discourse to Gamanin. Thus have I heard. Madhyama Agama 17, parallel to Samyukta Nikaya 42.6. This is in the fourth volume, page 311 of the PTS edition. So here we go. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying at Nalanda in Parvarika's mango grove. At that time, the seer Asita Devala had a son named Gamani, who was of majestic complexion and built, radiant and bright. Just before dawn, Gamani approached the place where the Buddha was, paid homage at the Buddha's feet, and stood to one side. Remark, something seems to have gone wrong here in the Chinese version, and the reference to this Gamini in the Pali version, we just have Asi Bandaka Putta, the son of Asi Bandaka, and this is clearly a human being. But here the bringing in of Asita Devala is surprising, and then this son is described as having a majestic complexion, radiant and bright, etc. This is the standard description of a deva and not of a human being. So there is something that is, I think, gone wrong here with the Chinese version. I continue reading. Gamani, the son of Asita Devala, said, "Blessed one, Brahmins arrogantly claim that they serve various gods and that they can, at will, cause beings to reach a good realm of existence after death, to be reborn in a heavenly realm. The Blessed One is the King of Dharma. May the Blessed One cause people to reach a good realm of existence after death, to be reborn in a heavenly realm." The Blessed One said, "Now, Gamani, I shall ask you something. Answer according to your understanding. What do you think, Gamani? If in a village there are men and women who are lazy and indolent, and who behave in evil ways, undertaking the 10 unwholesome courses of action, killing living beings, taking what is not given, sexual misconduct, false speech, and so on, up to wrong view. At the time of their death, crowds of people come, placing their palms together, praising and imploring, saying, 'You men and women, who have been lazy and indolent, and have behaved in evil ways, because of this, conditioned by this, after the breaking up of the body at death, you shall reach a good realm of existence and be reborn in a heavenly realm.' Gamani, those men and women, who have been lazy and indolent, and have behaved in evil ways, on being urged when near death, by those crowds of people, will they, because of this, conditioned by this, after the breaking up of the body at death, reach a good realm of existence and be reborn in a heavenly realm?" Gamani replied, "No, Blessed One." The Blessed One praised him, saying, "Very good, Gamani. Why so? Let those men and women should reach a good realm of existence and be reborn in a heavenly realm, this is not possible. Just a remark, the abbreviation is my own. I'm just abbreviating the text to make it not so boring when I read it out all to you. I continue. Now there comes a simile. Suppose, Kamini, that there were a deep lake full of water, located not far from a village, and a man were to throw a large, heavy rock into it. If a crowd of people came along, placing their palms together, praising and imploring, and said, "Rock, may you float up, come out." What do you think, Kamini, on being urged by that crowd of people who come, placing their palms together, praising and imploring? Because of this, conditioned by this, would that large heavy rock come out? Kamini replied, "No, blessed one." So it is, Kamini, those men and women, etc., that they should reach a good realm of existence and be reborn in a heavenly realm, this is not possible. And why not? These 10 unwholesome causes of action are black and have black results. By nature they incline downward, certainly leading to a bad realm of existence. Remark, the indication that these unwholesome causes of actions are black is not found in the Pali parallel. I continue. What do you think, Kamini? If in a village there are men and women who are diligent and energetic and practice the sublime Dharma, undertaking the 10 wholesome courses of action, and at the time of their death, crowds of people come, placing their palms together, praising and imploring them, saying, "You men and women, after the breaking up of the body, at death, you shall reach a bad realm of existence, be reborn in hell." What do you think, Kamini? Those men and women who have been diligent and energetic, and have practiced the sublime Dharma, undertaking the 10 wholesome courses of action, on being urged by the crowds of people, will they, because of this, conditioned by this, after the breaking up of the body, at death, reach a bad realm of existence and be reborn in hell? Kamini replied, "No, blessed one." The Buddha praises him, says that these are white actions, and then comes out with a simile. Kamini, suppose there were a deep lake full of water located not far from a village, and a man were to throw into the water a jar full of ghee and oil, and then break it, so that fragments of the jar sank downward, while the ghee and oil floated upward. Kamini, it is the same with those men and women who have been diligent and energetic and have practiced the sublime Dharma, undertaking the 10 wholesome courses of action, etc. At the time of their death, the body, which is gross matter, composed of the 4 elements, was born of father and mother, nourished and raised in dependence on food, is of a nature to break up, of a nature to cease, of a nature to be dispersed. After death, it will be pecked at by ravens, or eaten by tigers and wolves, or burned, or buried, or finally become ashes and dust. A remark again, this passage, description of the body, its nature, and its falling apart is not found in the Samyutta Nikaya parallel. The same is also for what comes later on about uplift and the Eightfold Noble Path, which I will read to you now. However, their mind, their mental faculty, their consciousness, having been constantly pervaded by faith, diligent, much learning, generosity and wisdom, because of this, conditioned by this, by nature they will ascend, to be reborn in a good realm of existence. Kamini, those who kill living beings, if they refrain from killing and abandon killing, then they are on the path of uplift, the path of ascent and progress, the path to a good realm of existence. Kamini, those who take what is not given, who engage in sexual misconduct, false speech, and so on, up to those who have wrong view, if they abstain from wrong view and acquire right view, then they are on the path of uplift, the path of ascent and progress, the path to a good realm of existence. Moreover, Gamani, there is another path of uplift, another path of ascent and progress, another path to a good realm of existence. What, Gamini, is this other path of uplift? It is the Eightfold Noble Path, Bright View, and so on, up to Bright Concentration, these eight. Gamini, this too is a path of uplift, a path of ascent and progress, a path to a good realm of existence. This is what the Buddha said. Having heard the Buddha's words, Gamini and the monks were delighted and remembered them well. As I said, this later part of the discourse is different in the Samyutta Nikaya version. This whole notion of the path of uplift and also the reference to the Eightfold Noble Path is not found. And it differs also in the conclusion, as here the visitor to the Buddha, whose name as Asi Bandakaputta, takes refuge. Nevertheless, the main points of the discourse is similar in both versions. We have the main statement that rebirth in hell or heaven depends on one's own conduct and not on prayers by others. And this is compared to a stone thrown in water will sink to the bottom, and oil thrown in water will rise to the surface. This completes my presentation of this discourse, and now there is room for any question or comment. Manfred Wiesberger says, mind, mental faculty, consciousness will ascend, sounds a lot like a soul. I am not sure about that. The early Buddhism clearly recognizes that there is something that is reborn, and that is usually referred to as consciousness. The consciousness that will be reborn, and it is only criticized if one says that precisely the same consciousness is being reborn, but consciousness as a flow, we get in the Digha Nikaya, the Vijnana Sota, that goes from one life to the other, and we also have in the Majjhima Nikaya somewhere the expression the Sangvattanika Vijnana, that is actually in Anindasapaya Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 106, if I am not quoting wrongly from memory, and also found in the Tibetan parallel. I think soul or self, Atman, is being denied in Buddhism only in so far as it is unchanging and has the intrinsic quality of control. But the anatta or not soul teaching do not deny the existence of an impermanent and changing flux of mental phenomena, a continuity of mind or mental states or consciousness, which continues throughout life and from one life to the other. And we need to distinguish this notion of impermanence and flux from later tradition, later in the commentarial tradition of Theravada and other schools, where impermanence becomes momentary disappearance. This is not the teaching on impermanence found in the early discourses, where we have upārutipanyāyati vāyatipanyāti tassa anyattatātipanyāyati. I can't now tell you offhand where that is, somewhere in the Anguttara Nikāya. Arising is designated, a passing away is designated, and a tittassa anyattatā, an otherwiseness of that which persists. That is, when something changes, it arises, it is there for some time as a changing, as a process, and then it disappears again. So the difficulty of explaining continuity and rebirth arises only with the later notion of impermanence, that everything as the immediately disappears. As soon as something appears immediately, it is gone again. But that is not the view we get in the early discourses. I think Manfred has again caught me out by asking a question just to get a long explanation. Would mind, mental faculty, conscience here signify the same thing or three different things? We have the same also sometimes in Pali. We get this citta, mano, vijnana, these three terms. And sometimes they are presented as synonyms, but on their own they have slightly different flavor. Vijnana on its own is consciousness through the six sense doors, and mano is the sixth sense door, the intellect, the thinking and reasoning mind. Citta is the heart, the seat of emotion, mind as an emotional state. So these are overlapping terms that can be used as synonyms, but can also be seen as showing different aspects of the mind. At the moment of passing away and being reborn, in the Pali discourses, the term usually used is vijnana, the consciousness. We don't get the mind, mano, being reborn, or the citta being reborn. It's the vijnana that is being reborn. And in this context, vijnana does not stand for the fifth aggregate only, but for the entirety of mind. There are other questions, please. So then we come to the other discourses that I wanted to look at today. We have another two discourses for next time that fits the situation well. Was there a question by Robert? I saw some typing, but maybe you're just giving secret messages to each other. I shouldn't be noticing that, no? Well, I just continue and see until something appears. So we are now getting into the discourse to Siha, Madhyama Agama number 18, and the parallel to a discourse found among the 8th of the Anguttara Nikaya, the 12th of these. And this is volume 4, page 179 of the PTS edition. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Buddha was staying at Vesali in the gabled hall near the Monkey Lake. At that time, many Lichavis from Vesali had come together in the assembly hall, frequently speaking in praise of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the community of monks. At that time, Senior Minister Siha, a disciple of the Nigantas, was also in the assembly. Just a remark, the Nigantas is another term for the giants. I continue. Then Senior Minister Siha had the wish to visit the Buddha and pay homage to him. Senior Minister Siha went first to the place of the Nigantas and told the Nigantas, "Venerable Sirs, I wish to go and visit the recluse Gotama." Then the Nigantas reprimanded Siha, saying, "You should not wish to visit the recluse Gotama. Why? The recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on inaction, and he proclaims to people a teaching of inaction. Siha, to visit someone who asserts a doctrine of inaction is inauspicious, and it is also inauspicious to pay homage to him." The discourse continues by repeating that the same happens again, and then a third occasion. I continue reading the discourse. On the third occasion, Senior Minister Siha, without asking leave of the Nigantas, approached the Buddha. Having exchanged greetings, he sat down to one side and said, "I have heard thus. The recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on inaction, and he proclaims to people a teaching of inaction. Gotama, if someone speaks thus, the recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on inaction. Is that person not misrepresenting the recluse Gotama? The Blessed One replied, Sir, if someone speaks thus, the recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on inaction, and he proclaims to people a teaching of inaction. He does not misrepresent the recluse Gotama. Why is that? I have given numbers here to make it easier. These are obviously not found in the original. So the first argument, Siha, there's a way in which, according to the true Dharma, one would not misrepresent me in saying the recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on inaction, and he proclaims to people a teaching of inaction. Again, Siha, there's another way in which, according to the true Dharma, one would not misrepresent me in saying the recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on action, and he proclaims to people a doctrine of action. Then we get the same for a teaching based on annihilation, based on abhorrence, based on dharma and vinaya, based on asceticism, based on not entering a womb to be reborn, and based on attaining peace. And he proclaims to people a teaching of attaining peace. I have just put down the Anguttara Nikaya parallels for you. Just a small remark, I keep on seeing that, there's a remark by Robert, so I'll take that first before Kurt looking at this parallel. The discourse mentioned two ascending paths. One path was via the 10 ways of ethical behavior, the other via the Eightfold Noble Path. The 10 facets of ethical behavior, all quite basic apart from right view, which is never fully right until one reaches enlightenment. When is the right view enough to be ethical? The Eightfold Noble Path is only developed when one reaches enlightenment, hence this is a much longer way upward. Yeah, that's an interesting question and something that resonates a little bit with the comment that Darshana Makavita, or question that Darshana Makavita made on the blog already. I think we should not take it that right view is a complete impossibility before the first level of awakening stream entry has been attained. Rather, there's a gradual development. And as long as one has the intention of keeping the right perspective, then for all those of us who have not yet become streamer, that is perfectly enough, I think. And I personally find for this purpose the more relevant formulation of right view to be the one that works by way of the Four Noble Truths, not the one that we saw last time, where I also mentioned that I have some difficulties in understanding the formulation of affirming or denial of the efficacy of sacrifice, the reference to spontaneously arisen beings. Rather, I think the point is simply that as a guiding principle for one's own life, one looks at any kind of situation of conflict or dukkha, in quotation marks, by taking up responsibility. Taking up responsibility, I mean that whatever dukkha happens, there's always a part of me that contributes to that. So instead of blaming my wife, my husband, my teacher, my student, my family, my country, my government, my whatsoever, and the first thing we should be looking for is my own contribution by way of craving to the present experience of dukkha. And seeing that there is a way out of me, out of that situation for me, simply by giving up that craving. That is a very practical form of right view. That is something that can be undertaken by anybody before he or she has become a stream enterer. And in this way, it is a very clear way leading upward. And it is also verifiable in one's own experience that this makes the whole difference. When I, small little story, I think I have time for that. when I came first to Sri Lanka, my whole purpose was to meet Venamalayana Ponika, and on the airport I was told that a few days before that he had just passed away. So I managed nevertheless to go to the forest hermitage, and my own fortune was that at that time Bhikkhu Bodhi had to go away, and so he left me there alone. So I sat in the seat of Venamalayana Ponika, kind of thinking that the person I wanted to meet had been sitting there not too long ago, but unfortunately I have been too late to meet him in person. And sitting on his chair in front of his desk, my attention was drawn to a small piece of paper that he apparently had on top of where he was doing his writing work. And it was in German, and it just said something like, I don't remember precisely, but something like, what are you doing now? Is it leading to dukkha or away from it? Just a very, very short kind of thing, and that really struck me. You might say that no need for any kind of supernatural explanation that he was still there and drawing my attention to that. I think we can just simply say that I connected to his energy and then I saw that, please. But it has been a very very practical and simple way of putting into operation my view. It's just very simple. What I'm doing now, is it leading to dukkha or leading away from it? And we can put in brackets, leading to dukkha for myself and others, or leading away from dukkha, brackets, for myself and others. And that makes things very simple, I think. Thank you for the question. Coming back to my comparative study of the Madhyama Agama and the Anguttara Discourse, so we have a slightly different listing here. The Anguttara Nikaya also works through annihilation, inaction, annihilation, abhorrence. The fourth is different. It has nihilism. And I think there's a problem with the Chinese translation here, because nihilism actually is vinayiko samanugotamo vinayaya dhammang diseti. So the vinayaya can easily be misread as vinaya. And there we get the dhamma vinaya. And there we have the number four in the Chinese, the base on dharma and vinaya. So I think the difference here is based on a misunderstanding of the Indic original on the side of the Chinese translators. Quite probable. Okay, now the discourse moves through these aspects more in detail. Siha, what is the way in which, according to the true Dharma, one would not misrepresent me in saying the recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on inaction, and he proclaims to people a teaching of inaction? Siha, I proclaim that evil bodily actions are not to be done. Evil verbal and mental actions are not to be done. Siha, the countless unwholesome and defiled states of this kind, which are the basis of future existence, which result in dukkha and vexation, and are the cause of birth, old age, sickness and death, I proclaim that all of these are not to be done. This, Siya, is the way in which, according to the true Dharma, one would not misrepresent me in saying the recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on inaction, and he proclaims to people a teaching of inaction. Siya, what is the way in which, according to the true Dharma, one would not misrepresent me in saying the recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on action, and he proclaims to people a teaching of action? Siya, I proclaim that good bodily actions are to be done, that good verbal and mental actions are to be done, etc. We get the same type of exposition then for the topics of annihilation and abhorrence. The fourth then is the Dharma Vinaya, where, as I said, I have the suspicion that the Chinese translators misunderstood a term in the Indian original. Siha, I teach the Dharma and Vinaya for the sake of abandoning sensual desire. I declare the Dharma and Vinaya for the sake of abandoning hatred and ignorance. The next one is based on asceticism, and the Buddha proclaims to people a teaching of asceticism. Here we get a very long description that I'm now going to read to you, which is not found in the Anguttara Nikaya parallel. And even this long description that I will now read to you, I have considerably abbreviated it. It gives us various types of ascetic practices. Excuse me. That apparently were undertaken in ancient India. We get similar descriptions elsewhere in the Pali discourses. See how I'm reading the discourse now. There are recluses and Brahmins who go naked and unclothed, who will not eat food from a house where there's a pregnant woman, or who eat one mouthful and are content with one mouthful, or who eat only the alms they obtain at a single house and are content with what they obtain at a single house, or who go to secluded places and live off what they find in seclusion, eating roots or fruits or fallen fruits, or who wear complete hides, or who keep their hair disheveled, or who tear out their hair, or who stand continuously abstaining from sitting, or who worship fire, keeping it burning continuously. In my presentation of this passage, I have given only one example of each type. The discourse actually gives a lot of different variations of each of these different types of ascetic practices. Like the house where there is a pregnant woman, then they will not eat from a house where there is a dog, from this and that type of house. There's a whole list every time. I continue with the discourse. In these ways, they experience untold dukkha in the practice of self-mortification. Siya, there is such asceticism. I do not deny it. But Siya, such asceticism is lowly action, leading to dukkha, leading to distress, a practice of worldlings. It is not the noble path. Siya, for the Tathagata, free from attachment and fully awakened, the method of asceticism consists in knowing defilements, abandoning them, causing them to cease completely, rooting them out and cutting them off, so that they would never arise again. Siha, this is the way in which, according to the true Dharma, one would not misrepresent me in saying the recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on asceticism, and he proclaims to people a teaching of asceticism. Next comes point 6, based on not entering a womb to be reborn. Siha, the Tathagata, free from attachment and fully awakened, through higher knowledge abandon future rebirth in a womb, cause future rebirth to cease completely, rooted it out and cut it off, so that it will not arise again. For this reason I will not again enter a womb. Siha, this is the way in which, according to the true Dharma, one would not misrepresent me in saying, the recluse Gotama's doctrine is based on not entering a womb to be reborn, and he proclaims to people a teaching on not entering a womb. And the 7th, based on attaining peace. The passage that comes is not found in the Anguttara Nikaya. Siha, I attained fully the summit of the holy life, for the sake of which a clansman shaves off hair and beard, dons the yellow robe, leaves home out of faith, and goes forth to practice the path. In this very life, I have personally attained understanding and awakening, and I dwell having personally realized it. I know as it really is, birth is ended, the holy life has been established. What was to be done has been done. There will not be another existence. Remark, even though this is not found in the Anguttara Nikaya parallel, this is however a standard description that we will also find in other contexts in the Pali discourses. I continue with the Madhyama Agama version. Having attained peace myself, I bring peace to other monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen. Having brought peace to them, I bring liberation from birth to other living beings who are subject to birth, subject to old age, subject to disease, subject to death. I bring liberation from sorrow, sadness, and defilements to other beings who are subject to sorrow, sadness, and defilements. Siha, this is the way in which, according to the true Dharma, one would not misrepresent me in saying The recluse Gautama's doctrine is based on attaining peace, and he proclaims to people a teaching of peace. Siya now takes refuge and asks to be accepted as a lay follower. And this is, again, I give this from the Madhyama Agama version. Blessed One, just as a person who raises a bad horse, expecting to get benefit from it, only tires himself and gets no benefit. Blessed One, I was like this. Those foolish Nigantas lack right knowledge. They do not know for themselves. Not recognizing the fertile field of the Buddha's teaching, and not examining for myself, I long revered them, made offerings, and paid them homage, expecting to get benefit from it, but I only suffered in vain. Blessed One, for a second time I now go for refuge, etc. Blessed One, I was formerly ignorant. Whatever faith and respect I had for those foolish Nigantas has today been cut off. Why? Because I was deceived. Blessed One, for a third time I now go for refuge. This is what the Buddha said. Having heard the Buddha's words, senior minister Siha and the monks were delighted and remembered them well. The Anguttara Nikaya parallel has a rather substantial difference in this final part. After Siha has taken refuge, and he doesn't do it by... He is a general in the Pali version, and he doesn't do it with this calling the Nigantas foolish, I think, if I remember correctly. Anyhow, there's a whole different story that happens in the Pali version now. The Buddha tells Siha that he should reflect very carefully on what he's doing. And General Siha is very pleased to find that the Buddha advises him in this way, instead of using his conversion for propaganda purposes. And when he thereon expresses for a second time that he takes refuge, the Buddha tells him that he should nevertheless continue supporting the giants, the Nigantas, with arms as he had done earlier. Now Siya is even more pleased, because he had heard the rumor that the Buddha was telling people that only he and his disciples should be given arms, not others. And now he finds that the Buddha is actually encouraging him to continue supporting the giants, even though Siya has changed his discipleship or affiliation to Buddhism. Then the Buddha gives him a gradual instruction, and Siya becomes a stream mentor. Now, as you already noticed, this whole episode is not found in the Madhyama Agama version at all. We have another instance of this whole passage, that is, a giant follower who is converted, who takes refuge, is told, reflect carefully, takes refuge again, is told to continue supporting the giants, gets a gradual instruction and becomes a stream enterer, in the Upali Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 56. And in this case, we also have the fairly similar passage in the Madhyama Agama version. This parallelism gives the impression that this passage originally belongs to the Upali Sutta, and in the case of the Siya Sutta, it has been added to the Pali version. If this hypothesis should be correct, then this addition happened at an early stage in the transmission of the Pali discourse, because now the Siha Sutta is found not only among the eights of the Anguttara Nikaya, but also in the Vinaya. So we have two times the same story. Whatever may be the last word on the hypothesis that the Anguttara Nikaya version of the Siha Sutta has incorporated this whole part, the story continues. Siha invites the Buddha and the monks for a meal. And when he gets some fresh meat for the meal, it's a pavatta mangsa, the giants, who have found out that he has left their folds, start making a rumor in the roads of the city, saying that an animal has been killed specifically for the sake to provide food to the Buddha and his monks. And in the Vinaya version of this story, this then leads up to a rule that monastics should not partake of meat. When they know or suspect that the animal is killed on purpose for them, which was not the case with the meat that Siha got. And I just take this as an occasion during the final 5 minutes of today's lecture to go a little bit more on to the issue of meat consumption, because even though this is not found in the Madhyama Agama version, it is found in the Pali discourse. Now, the main point about consumption of meat by monastics is that as a monk or a nun in the ancient times goes begging out on the road of the town, they are going have to accept whatever is given to them. Nevertheless, excuse me, the Jivaka Sutta gives and the Vinaya ruling makes an exception to that. And that is, if one suspects that an animal has been specifically killed to provide meat for oneself, then one is allowed to refuse it. And one is also allowed to refuse meat if it is from some kind of wild animal, like elephant meat or lion meat, etc. The reason there is not ethical, it's just that if these wild animals supposedly are able to smell that one has eaten the meat of one of their species, then it's more probable that they will attack one when one lives alone in the forest. Now the same Jivaka Sutta also examines the case of what happens when somebody offers meat that has been specifically slaughtered for this meal offering to a monastic. And it points out that in such a case, the layperson who does that incurs demerit, anti-merit, on 5 occasions. And I have listed them down here. First of all, when that person says, bring that animal to be slaughtered. The second, when the animal is actually suffering fear. Most animals know what is going to happen to them. You can see that if you go to slaughterhouses. Animals are frantic. Third, when he is giving the order, now kill the animal. Fourth, when the animal is actually being killed. And fifth, when he is offering this meat of the animal slaughtered on purpose for giving meal to a disciple of the Tathagata. When he offers it, it's the fifth instant of demerit. What about a layperson's own consumption of meat? There's a important discourse here that describes a threefold purity in regard to abstention from killing, the Veludvareya Sutta. And I just read this passage to you. The noble disciple reflects, I am one who wants to live, who does not want to die. If someone were to take my life, that would not be agreeable and acceptable to me. Now, if I were to take the life of another, of one who wants to live, who does not want to die, that would not be agreeable and acceptable to the other. What is disagreeable and unacceptable to me is disagreeable and unacceptable to the other too. How can I inflict upon another what is disagreeable and unacceptable to me? Having reflected in this way, he abstains himself from killing, establishes others in abstaining from killing, and praises abstinence from killing. Thus his bodily conduct is purified in 3 respects. Besides the golden rule, what I do not want others to do to me, I should not do to others, I find very significant this threefold purification that is mentioned here. Sometimes we get the argument that consumption of meat and fish is quite okay for a Buddhist lay follower, because as long as one does not kill the animal oneself, one is absolved from any breach of the training rule to abstain from killing. But I think this does not really work if we look at it from the perspective of this discourse. You see, even just buying meat without doing the killing oneself it is obviously stronger if one kills oneself. But buying meat, just buying meat in the butcher's shop or in the supermarket, you are failing to fulfill this threefold purity. And there is also a logic to that. I mean, the butcher keeps killing as long as he's able to sell the meat. So if somebody buys meat, by that very act of buying, he or she is directly encouraging the killing instead of encouraging abstinence from killing. Anyway, that was just a sidelight on meat eating and the way how, according to my view, the canonical position regarding the issue of vegetarianism would be. But this is a much debated issue, so I just present my view, and I do not want to intend you to have to accept this wholesale. We are coming to the end now. It's already 7:45. I still owe you 5 minutes from I don't know how many weeks ago. The main point that Madhyama Agama 18 makes is a reinterpretation of concepts like non-action, annihilation, and asceticism. Yeah, I think that was all I had to say today, and I thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to seeing you again next week at what will be the last session in this series of talks, but I'm definitely going to continue next year. Goodbye and have a nice time.